Picture the first, I don't know, 10 minutes of your morning. You wake up, you roll over, and you just instinctively reach for that glowing rectangle on your right stand.
Right, before your feet even hit the floor.
Exactly. Before you even stand up, you are instantly plugged into this sprawling network of humanity. You've got emails from colleagues, group texts from your family, notifications from hundreds, maybe thousands of people who can see what you posted the night before.
Yeah, your pocket is just going to vibrate with that frictionless contact all day long.
Right. You are living in a world that is meticulously engineered to make you the most reachable, hyper-visible version of a human being in history. And yet there is this massive paradox sitting right at the center of the 2025 and 2026 era.
It's a huge paradox.
Because despite all of that digital proximity, statistically speaking, either you or someone you care about deeply is waking up this morning experiencing just profound, bone-deep emotional isolation.
Yeah, it really is the defining architectural failure of modern society.
Yeah.
I mean, we spent the last two decades optimizing our entire culture for speed and efficiency and scale. And in the process, we basically managed to completely engineer out the structural foundations of human belonging.
We really
We
did.
built a world where it's incredibly easy to transmit data, but, incredibly difficult to actually feel known.
And we are way past the point of treating this as just a, well, a poetic private sorrow. We're looking at some recent data from the World Health Organization's Commission on Social Connection, and it absolutely reshapes how we need to look at this.
The numbers are staggering.
They really are. They found that one in six people globally, that's nearly 16% of the human population, is experiencing profound loneliness. But the mortality impact, I mean, that is what takes this out of the realm of sociology and turns it into a full-blown biological crisis.
Definitely.
Loneliness is currently linked to an estimated 871,000 deaths annually. If you do the math on that, it translates to roughly 100 people dying every single hour from causes directly related to severe social disconnection.
100 people an hour, which forces a complete paradigm shift in public health, really. For a long time, the medical community treated loneliness as like a secondary issue.
Right, like just a symptom.
Exactly, a symptom of depression, maybe, or just an unfortunate byproduct getting older. But seeing 100 deaths an hour categorizes social isolation as an acute primary pathogen. It is a biological threat state.
And it's wild because we obsess over physical health in such granular detail now. You know, we count our daily steps, we track our macros, we totally agonize over whether we're getting enough deep sleep or if we're sitting at our desks for too long.
Absolutely.
But the physical biological impact of severe social disconnection is functionally equivalent to smoking up to 15 cigarettes a day.
15 a day.
Yeah.
It's almost hard to wrap your head around.
It is. It's actually worse for your cardiovascular system than physical inactivity or obesity. So today on this deep dive, we are moving far beyond that superficial advice of, you know, just go out more or join a local club.
Right, because that doesn't actually solve the biological problem.
Exactly. So our mission today is to synthesize neurobiology, modern sociology, urban architecture, and the philosophical framework of the fractal worldview to really understand the mechanics of this crisis.
We're going to get into some fascinating territory.
We really are. We're going to explore why a constant stream of text messages fails to register as connection to your nervous system, how isolation physically alters your DNA, and most importantly, how we can systematically rebuild genuine human resonance.
Yeah, and to understand why the absence of connection feels so physically devastating, we really have to look under the hood of the human body. We have to examine the baseline expectations of our biology.
Right, because our culture tells a very different story than our biology does.
Exactly. Modern culture champions total independence as the ultimate goal of a successful adult. But the human brain does not view independence as a victory. In fact, it views total independence as an evolutionary emergency.
Okay, let's unpack this because this brings to mind James Cohen's work on social baseline theory, which completely flips the script on how we perceive our own autonomy.
It really does. The traditional assumption in psychology was always that a human being's baseline state is solitary.
Right, like you're just a standalone unit.
Yeah, a standalone unit and interacting with others is this secondary action that requires extra energy. But Cohen's theory argues the exact opposite. The brain's default state-like, its baseline expectation for functioning, fundamentally expects proximity to familiar, predictable, and supportive others.
Because the brain is, well, it's essentially a massive energy hog.
Oh, massive. I mean, the human brain makes up only about 2% of our total body weight, but it consumes roughly 20% of our metabolic energy.
That is a crazy ratio.
It is. And throughout our evolutionary history, survival in these harsh environments depended entirely on the cooperative pooling of resources. Early humans had to share the immense labor of hunting, gathering, maintaining collective vigilance against predators.
So it couldn't do it all alone.
Exactly. Because the brain is so metabolically expensive, it evolved to outsource a massive portion of its regulatory burden to the surrounding community. In neurobiology, we call this concept load sharing.
Load sharing. It's remarkably similar to how a smartphone operates. Like, imagine you are out in the wilderness with no Wi-Fi.
Right. Your battery just tanks.
Exactly. Your phone is constantly searching for a signal. It's running a dozen background applications, trying to ping cell towers, attempting to download data, managing the brightness of the screen to adjust to the sun. Your battery drains incredibly fast because the device is handling the entire processing burden totally alone.
That is a highly accurate parallel, actually.
But then, when you walk into a house and connect to a secure, stable Wi-Fi network, you essentially offload all that background processing to the cloud. You share the computing power, and your battery is conserved.
Yeah, and when you are alone, your brain is running all of its survival applications simultaneously.
Just burning battery.
Exactly. It's scanning the environment for threats. It's actively regulating your body temperature. It's managing your baseline anxiety, plotting out how to acquire resources.
It sounds exhausting.
It is. But when you're in the physical presence of trusted companions, your brain recognizes that external support, and it shuts down those expensive background processes. It offloads the vigilance to the group. And what is truly fascinating is that this load sharing literally alters your physical perception of the world.
The Hill steepness studies are the perfect example of this.
Oh, I love those studies.
They are so cool. Researchers took participants, placed them at the bottom of a physical hill, and just asked them to estimate the incline.
Just by looking at it.
Just looking at it. And when a subject was standing completely alone, their brain calculated the hill as significantly steeper and way more demanding to climb. But when that exact same person stood next to a trusted friend, their visual perception actually changed. The hill literally looked less steep to them.
Because the brain is constantly calculating the bioenergetic cost of the climb.
Right.
When the friend is present, the brain assumes, well, if I get injured or if I run out of energy on this incline, there is a secondary source of energy standing right next to me to help.
That's like a safety net.
Exactly. Therefore, the obstacle requires less internal resource allocation. The physical reality of the environment is softened by the presence of a social bond.
So the inverse of that is deeply alarming. When you are socially isolated, your brain registers a massive catastrophic loss of bioenergetic resources. It assumes you are now facing every single threat in the environment entirely alone.
Yeah, and to compensate for that perceived vulnerability, it forces your body into a state of chronic hypervigilance.
You literally go into metabolic debt. I mean, you could be sitting perfectly still on your sofa, totally safe in a locked apartment, but internally, your brain is sounding this evolutionary alarm, burning through energy to keep you on high alert.
Just running all those background apps.
Exactly. And this constant strain elevates your resting heart rate, it spikes your fasting blood glucose, and over time, it actually accelerates cognitive decline. Solitude is a biologically expensive luxury.
It really is. Which brings us to the mechanics of how we actually turn that alarm off. Like, how do we signal to another nervous system that they can conserve their battery?
Right.
This is where Stephen Porges' polyvagal theory is essential. Polyvagal theory maps out the role of our autonomic nervous system, specifically focusing on a pathway called the ventral vagal complex.
Okay, the ventral vagal complex.
Yeah. This is the neurological network responsible for social engagement. And what's critical to understand is that the vagus nerve doesn't just sit up in the brain. It physically branches down and links to the muscles of your face, your middle ear, your vocal cords, and your heart.
So if I am sitting across a table from someone, my ventral vagal complex is actively searching for specific physical data from them to determine if I am safe.
Yes. It is engaging in a process called neuroception.
Neuroception.
Right. And this happens entirely below your conscious awareness. Your nervous system is basically acting like a radar, constantly scanning the interpersonal space between you and the other person.
What exactly is it looking for?
It's listening for the melodic prosody of a warm human voice. You know, the natural rise and fall of speech, rather than a flat, monotonous tone.
Oh, like when someone is genuinely happy to see you.
Exactly. And it is tracking the subtle micro expressions around the eyes that indicate a genuine smile. It's looking for sustained, gentle eye contact.
And when my radar picks up those specific visual and auditory cues, it stimulates the ventral vagal nerve, which then sends a direct signal down into the amygdala, the brain's threat center, telling it to power down the alarm systems.
Exactly.
So my internal calm is directly biologically tethered to your physical cues.
We call this co-regulation. And what's fascinating here is that understanding co-regulation requires us to dismantle one of the most pervasive myths of modern wellness culture.
The idea of self-regulation.
Yes. We are constantly sold this idea of self-regulation. The cultural narrative dictates that a successful, mature adult should be able to self-soothe in total isolation through sheer willpower or mental discipline. But neurobiologically speaking, pure self-regulation is a fallacy.
Wait, so self-regulation is entirely a neurobiological fallacy?
Pretty much. Because what we call self-regulation is actually just internalized co-regulation.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. A child only learns how to calm their own nervous system because a caregiver or a community provided the physical, biological scaffolding for them to do so over and over again. We absorb the calming physical presence of others to build the internal architecture of peace.
So without that continuous biological feedback loop, a human nervous system will just endlessly struggle to find equilibrium.
Precisely. And that biological feedback loop extends well beyond sight and sound. It requires physical touch, which is, unfortunately, increasingly engineered out of our daily lives.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about touch starvation, because the biology here is incredible. The human somatosensory system features these specialized nerve fibers in the skin known as C-tactile afferents.
CT afferents.
Right. And unlike the nerves that detect pain or temperature or the sharp pressure of bumping into a table, C-tactile afferents are incredibly specific. They only respond to slow, gentle, effective touch.
The kind of touch you experience during a long embrace or a hand resting on your shoulder.
Exactly. They are evolutionarily tuned to the exact speed and temperature of a human caress. And when those C-tactile fibers are stimulated, they initiate this whole cascade of responses that travel to the brain and trigger the release of endogenous oxytocin from the hypothalamus.
Endogenous meaning the oxytocin is produced naturally inside the body.
Right. And we casually refer to oxytocin as the cuddle chemical, but its actual physiological job is so much more important than that. It acts as a buffer for the HPA axis.
The hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. That is the body's central stress response system. When the HPA axis is activated by a threat, it floods the body with cortisol.
The stress hormone.
Right. But when endogenous oxytocin is released via slow physical touch, it physically binds to receptors that attenuate the HPA axis. It acts as a biological brake pedal, lowering cortisol levels and stopping the stress response in its tracks.
This reveals such a massive blind spot in how we communicate today. I mean, digital communication, a four-hour high-definition video call, hundreds of supportive text messages, a stream of voice notes, none of that has any capacity to stimulate a C-tactile afferent.
Not at all.
You can exchange an immense amount of intellectual and emotional information through a screen, but because the skin is starved of that specific tactile input, the neurobiological loop remains profoundly incomplete. You do not get the endogenous oxytocin release.
Which means your HPA axis remains unbuffered. Your cortisol stays elevated regardless of how many heart emojis you receive in a text.
Which is just wild to think about.
It is. And the physical starvation of the body in an era of digital abundance leads us to perhaps the most alarming biological consequence of all, which is the CTRA profile.
Okay, let's get into this.
When social isolation is prolonged, it ceases to be just a psychological state and becomes an epigenetic one. The feeling of loneliness actively alters how your genes express themselves, specifically changing the behavior of your white blood cells.
Wait, so feeling lonely actually changes gene expression? How does a feeling alter my white blood cells? That sounds like science fiction.
I know it does, but the mechanism behind it, the conserved transcriptional response to adversity, or CTRA, makes perfect sense when you view it through an evolutionary lens.
Okay, how so?
Well, let's place ourselves back on the ancestral savanna. If an ancient human is separated from their tribe, they are facing an immediate, two-pronged existential threat.
Right, because they're all alone in the wild.
Exactly. First, without the physical protection of the collective, that isolated human is highly likely to be attacked, bitten, or physically wounded by a predator.
Makes sense.
Second, because they are entirely removed from the proximity of other humans, their chances of catching a socially transmitted virus drop to near zero.
Oh, because there's nobody around to cough on them.
Right. And evolution is highly pragmatic It anticipates the physical wound from the predator, and it completely dismisses the viral threat.
So the isolated brain sends a signal via the sympathetic nervous system to alter the transcription factors inside the immune cells.
Yes.
And the CTRA profile executes two specific genetic shifts, right?
Correct.
First, it upregulates pro-inflammatory genes, specifically those controlled by a protein complex called NFKB. The body starts churning out excess systemic inflammation to prepare the immune system to fight the bacterial infection it assumes is coming from a predator's bite.
Simultaneously, it downregulates antiviral genes. It suppresses the body's innate antibody synthesis because it assumes there is no one around to catch a cold from. It strips the antiviral defenses to pour all available energy into creating inflammation.
The tragedy here is that this brilliant evolutionary mechanism is entirely mismatched to our current environment. I mean, if you are sitting in a high-rise apartment, completely physically safe from predators, but suffering from chronic emotional isolation, your body is operating as if a tiger is about to tear your arm off.
It really is.
Your immune system floods your bloodstream with sustained levels of cortisol and inflammation.
And over time, this constant flooding leads to a state known as glucocorticoid resistance.
What does that mean for the body?
Well, glucocorticoids, like cortisol, are steroid hormones that typically act as the body's natural fire extinguishers. They stop inflammation once a threat has passed.
No.
But when the body is drenched in them for months or years due to chronic loneliness, the tissues build up a tolerance. They go deaf to the anti-inflammatory signals.
Wow, so the fire extinguisher just stops working.
Exactly. The low-grade systemic inflammation just burns continuously through the body. And systemic inflammation is the primary driver of cardiovascular disease, stroke, metabolic syndrome, and the acceleration of dementia.
That is terrifying.
It is. This epigenetic shift is precisely why the mortality rate of loneliness is so staggering.
Yeah.
It rewrites your cellular biology to fight a physical threat that doesn't exist, while simultaneously dismantling the antiviral defenses you actually need to survive in a modern world.
So if you're chronically lonely today, you are essentially trapped in this biological state of glucocorticoid resistance. We have a biological system that will literally self-destruct if it is deprived of physical resonant connection.
Yeah.
So the big question becomes, why have we constructed a society that actively avoids it? We are constantly trading the biological necessity of connection for psychological compromises. We need to parse how modern culture has fundamentally conflated different layers of human interaction.
Because we confuse visibility with presence.
Yeah. Exactly. And the architecture of our digital platforms is built entirely on this conflation.
We can break human interaction down into four distinct layers. The foundational layer is simply contact. Contact is just the frictionless exchange of data. It's the ping of a notification, a brief text message confirming a time to meet, or, you know, an automated, like on a photo.
Right. It provides a momentary confirmation that you exist within a network, but it offers zero emotional sustenance.
Zero. It is entirely curated. It is a transaction.
And that leads to the second layer, which is attention. I love this quote from the source material, the Oracle 2.0. It argues that attention is the new currency of the soul. What you give your attention to, you feed.
That's a great framing.
Our digital ecosystems are explicitly engineered to harvest our attention, turning human gaze into a highly monetized commodity. But we mistake capturing an audience's attention for capturing their empathy. You can have millions of people looking at a highly edited video of your life, but that visibility does not equate to being deeply known.
Not at all. To move beyond contact and attention, you have to enter the third layer, which is intimacy. And intimacy is the real bottleneck for modern society because it requires the removal of armor.
The messy stuff.
Right. True intimacy demands vulnerability. It is the raw, unedited, unpredictable exposure of your actual self, flaws, contradictions, and all to another human being. It requires you to relinquish control over how you are perceived.
And if you can brave the friction of intimacy, you finally reach the fourth layer, connection or true resonance. This is a bi-directional state where two people are vibrating in harmony, recognizing a shared spark, participating in mutual load sharing.
But as Sherry Turkle's research in Alone Together outlines, we are actively settling for contact and attention because we are terrified of the vulnerability required for intimacy.
Turkle identifies this profound relational paradox. We've come to expect more from technology and less from each other.
Yeah.
Digital interfaces allow us to maintain absolute godlike control over our self-presentation. You can draft and redraft a text message to ensure you sound perfectly witty.
You can apply filters to smooth out your face.
Exactly. You can selectively edit out all the messy, awkward, unpredictable friction of real-time human emotion. We desire the illusion of companionship, but we want it completely stripped of all the demands and responsibilities of actual friendship.
We use screens as shields. We protect ourselves from the potential sting of rejection. But in doing so, we starve ourselves of the intimacy our biology requires. We are terrified of the friction, but we're dying from the starvation, leaving us alone together, physically occupying the same space, but mentally tethered to completely separate digital simulations.
Look, I have to play devil's advocate here for a second. For someone with severe social anxiety or someone who is geographically trapped and isolated, isn't an AI companion or a Twitch streamer a lifeline? Isn't some connection, even a digital one, better than absolutely zero?
This raises an important question, and it brings us to what's known as the substitution hypothesis. Yes, for someone trapped in a cycle of acute anxiety where the prospect of human rejection feels neurologically overwhelming, an AI companion does provide a safe harbor.
Right. It offers an immediate stabilization of the nervous system.
It gives a quick hit of dopamine, a sense of being heard, and a frictionless availability without any rejection. But relying on an artificial or parasocial bond as a primary source of connection is the emotional equivalent of consuming a diet made entirely of junk food.
Wow, junk food.
Yeah. It tastes good in the moment. It provides a rapid spike in caloric energy, but it completely lacks the vital complex nutrients required for sustained health.
Because it is fundamentally non-reciprocal. I mean, an AI chatbot is literally programmed to cater to you. An influencer on a screen is broadcasting a one-way performance. Neither of them requires anything from you in return.
Precisely. Real human connection is deeply nourished by reciprocal friction. When you engage with an AI, you are entirely deprived of social feedback. You are never challenged on your assumptions.
You never have to compromise your desires to accommodate someone else's bad mood.
You don't have to practice patience or forgiveness. And over time, your real-world social skills begin to atrophy. You lose the emotional muscle memory required to navigate the messy reality of a disagreement with a friend or a partner.
It creates this devastating self-isolating loop. You project your own unfulfilled emotional needs onto an algorithmic avatar which validates you perfectly, making the unpredictable nature of real human beings feel even more exhausting and unsafe.
Instead of doing the demanding work of building mutual trust, you retreat further into the frictionless simulation. The technology reinforces the exact alienation it promises to cure.
We are gorging ourselves on frictionless contact and dying of relational malnutrition. But to frame this purely as an individual failure, like a lack of willpower to just put the phone down, is to miss the massive structural forces at play.
Absolutely.
We have to shift our perspective from individual psychology to macro sociology and urban design. Because society's very structure, its economic demands and physical architecture, is aggressively pushing us into these isolated silos.
Sociologist Hartmut Rosa offers an incredible framework for this with his theory of social acceleration. He argues that late modernity is defined by a relentless, exponential increase in pace.
The speed of technological advancement, the rapid turnover of social norms.
The sheer volume of tasks required to just maintain a daily existence. It is all accelerated to a velocity that human neurology simply cannot process. Rosa describes this condition as a frenetic standstill.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Frenetic standstill is like running on a treadmill that keeps speeding up. Yeah. You're exhausted, you're sweating, you're putting in this massive amount of physical and mental effort just to not fall off the back of the machine.
But you're not actually moving forward.
Right. Despite all that frantic movement, you aren't advancing through space. And because you're so hyper-focused on survival, you certainly aren't pausing to connect with the scenery or the people running next to you.
That treadmill generates a profound state of sociological alienation. Alienation occurs when the world feels mute, transactional, and unresponsive.
Like everything is just a task.
Exactly. When you are forced to optimize every minute of your day for productivity, you inevitably begin to view your environment and the people within it as resources to be managed or obstacles to be overcome. A conversation with a neighbor is no longer a moment of connection. It is a delay in your schedule.
And when human beings become mere resources, social trust crumbles. To step off the treadmill, Rosa argues we need the antidote to alienation, which he defines as resonance.
Resonance, yes.
Resonance is an authentic, bi-directional encounter. It is a moment where you and another person are mutually moved and transformed. It requires deep affection, emotional investment, and most crucially, uncontrollability.
Uncontrollability is the key variable there. You cannot engineer a moment of resonance. You can't schedule it in an optimized calendar. You certainly can't purchase it.
It just happens spontaneously.
Right? It happens when you surrender the need to control the outcome of an interaction. Digital environments foster alienation precisely because they are designed to be entirely predictable and controllable. But the human nervous system requires the uncontrollable sensory reality of the other to experience the hum of true belonging.
Yet, the structural scaffolding required to facilitate those uncontrollable serendipitous moments is systematically being dismantled. We are living through what researchers term a structural friendship recession, characterized by a steep decline in platonic bonds.
And a massive driver of this recession is the fracturing of the workplace through the normalization of remote work.
Historically, the physical workplace served as a vital piece of organic social infrastructure.
It wasn't just a place of economic production. It provided repeated, low-stakes social overlap. You saw the same individuals every day. You had unstructured conversations walking to the parking lot or waiting by the coffee machine.
Trust was built slowly, incrementally, over hundreds of minor serendipitous encounters.
But remote work takes that organic, three-dimensional ecosystem and atomizes it. We are now geographically trapped in private domestic silos.
When I interact with a colleague now, it is entirely mediated by a screen. It's a scheduled 30-minute video call with a set agenda. The interaction is purely goal-oriented. The serendipity, the space before and after the meeting where actual human bonding occurs, is completely eliminated.
This structural loss is really compounded by a cultural shift that philosopher Byung-Chul Han diagnoses as communication without community.
Communication without community.
Right. Han observes that modern society has systematically abandoned the rituals that historically anchored human life.
And when we talk about rituals in this context, we aren't necessarily talking about grand esoteric ceremonies. We're talking about shared, predictable practices that establish a sense of meaning and continuity without the need for constant explicit communication.
Yeah, it's the weekly Sunday dinner with extended family.
Or the seasonal neighborhood block party. It's the simple routine of going to the same local diner at the exact same time every Saturday morning.
Rituals generate emotional intensity through repetition. They provide a predictable structure that makes time feel habitable. They create a shared sense of home, allowing individuals to simply exist together within a familiar framework.
But the neoliberal economic model demands constant novelty and endless productivity.
Exactly. It replaces the depth of ritual with what Han calls serial perception.
Serial perception.
Which is the shallow, relentless consumption of new stimuli, new trends, new information. We are actively discouraged from lingering.
We just consume the next video, the next piece of content, the next gig. Without rituals to anchor us, we are swept up in this rushing stream of time, constantly performing our identities for a digital audience while feeling completely unmoored internally.
And this loss of ritual is physically mirrored in the architecture of our cities through the death of the third place.
Okay, let's talk about third places. Sociologist Ray Oldenburg coined the term third place to describe the essential physical environments outside of the home, which is the first place, and the workplace, the second place.
Right. Third places are informal, highly accessible public spaces where community naturally unfolds. The local pub, the neighborhood cafe, the barbershop, the public park.
And the defining characteristic of a true third place is that it thrives on presence without performance and time without urgency. You are not required to purchase a ticket to enter. You do not have to achieve a specific goal while you are there. You belong simply by showing up.
It is an egalitarian space where status is temporarily suspended.
But hyper-commercialization and urban sprawl have decimated these ecosystems. Our physical environments are increasingly designed to move people quickly from point A to point B or to extract capital from them rather than to facilitate lingering.
The profound impact of architecture on human behavior becomes glaringly obvious when you look at cities that have actively preserved or reclaimed their third places.
Budapest serves as a brilliant case study in this architecture of belonging.
It really does.
Because the city rests on a geological fault line, it boasts over 100 active thermal springs, and over centuries, spanning the Roman, Ottoman, and Austro-Hungarian empires, they have built an elaborate public bathing culture around this geothermal reality.
It is a phenomenal example of designing for resonance.
Imagine this for a second. Imagine walking into the Szechenyi or Gellert baths early on a Tuesday morning. You step into this massive, naturally heated outdoor pool surrounded by stunning neo-Baroque architecture. Steam is rising off the water. The pool is filled with people, but they are not swimming laps for cardiovascular exercise.
No, it's not a gym.
Right. You see a group of retirees who have been meeting in that exact spot every morning for 3 decades, standing in chest-deep water, playing chess on floating cork boards. You see strangers striking up quiet conversations. The warm water is the medium, but the actual function of the space is deep social cohesion.
It is the ultimate unprogrammed environment. It grants human beings the unspoken cultural permission to simply linger together.
Yes, to linger.
When you enter the water, you are stripped of your professional attire, your markers of economic status, and crucially, your digital devices. You are reduced to just a physical body sharing a warm sensory space with your community.
It facilitates the exact kind of slow, low-stakes friction that builds the biological architecture of calm we discussed earlier.
It proves that if you build spaces that prioritize human lingering over commercial extraction, people will naturally connect. In post-socialist urban spaces like Budapest, there is a growing movement to reclaim abandoned industrial zones and transform them into communal hubs.
Prioritizing pedestrian environments and green spaces over isolated car-centric infrastructure. We have to purposefully design our physical world for resonance.
And addressing that physical design is critical because the architectural collapse of the third place, combined with the digital echo chamber, fractures our most vulnerable demographics in uniquely devastating ways.
Yes, the generational fault lines.
Exactly. While the crisis touches everyone, the generational fault lines reveal entirely different mechanisms of isolation. We really need to examine the crisis through the lens of the youth and the lens of the aging population.
Let's start with the youth demographic, specifically 13 to 29-year-olds. According to the WHO data, 21% of this demographic reports significant chronic loneliness. They are the most digitally connected, hyper-visible generation in the history of humanity, and simultaneously the most deeply isolated.
Within sociological and psychological literature, there's been a fierce debate regarding the root cause of this paradox. One side argues for the social enhancement hypothesis.
What does that suggest?
It suggests that online platforms allow teenagers who are already socially adept to expand their networks and find niche communities.
Okay, that sounds plausible.
It does, but the overwhelming weight of the data now heavily supports the alternative, the social displacement hypothesis.
The displacement hypothesis posits that the sheer volume of time and emotional energy a teenager spends passively scrolling on a smartphone directly cannibalizes the time they would have organically spent engaging in face-to-face interaction. The screen acts as a zero-sum game for their time.
Exactly. Passive consumption creates aggregated displacement effects.
Yeah.
An hour spent endlessly scrolling short-form videos in a bedroom is an hour not spent navigating the messy, real-time dynamics of a local park or a friend's basement.
Right.
This displacement systematically lowers subjective well-being, drives up rates of isolation, and immerses the developing brain in a constant stream of highly curated, entirely unrealistic social comparisons.
Think about the developing nervous system of a teenager scrolling alone in their room for 3 hours. The technology was marketed to them as a bridge to the wider world, but in practice, it acts as an impenetrable barrier.
It really does.
Their ventral vagal nerve is completely starved of the subtle facial cues, the micro expressions, and the vocal prosody it desperately needs to register safety. They're culturally hungry for connection, but neurobiologically, they are starving.
On the opposite end of the generational spectrum, the aging population faces a completely different mechanism of isolation. Older adults globally report slightly lower overall rates of loneliness, hovering around 11.8%. But the physiological consequences for this demographic are highly lethal.
Because their physical, real-world networks are organically shrinking anyway due to retirement, mobility limitations, and, well, the loss of peers.
Yes, the physical footprint of their world naturally contracts. But the massive compounding factor in the current era is digital exclusion.
Digital exclusion.
As society rushes toward total digital integration, essential services, community bulletins, healthcare portals, and even family group chats migrate entirely online.
And if they can't keep up.
Exactly. Older adults who lack the digital literacy or the physical dexterity to navigate these rapidly changing platforms are unceremoniously cut off from the flow of society. If we connect this to the bigger picture, public health researchers now classify digital exclusion as a supersocial determinant of health.
A supersocial determinant? Why?
It is a foundational barrier that exacerbates every other vulnerability. Being digitally excluded acts as an independent variable that drives up an older adult's risk of clinical depression by an astonishing 60%.
60%.
Furthermore, the lack of cognitive and social stimulation drastically accelerates cognitive decline and the loss of physical functioning. For an elderly individual, social isolation is not merely a sad emotional state, it is a rapid catalyst for total physical deterioration.
So the solution to this cannot be simply handing an 85-year-old an iPad, offering a quick tutorial, and declaring them connected. It requires a structural integration of care that the medical community is now calling social prescribing.
Social prescribing represents a major shift in treatment protocols. Instead of solely prescribing pharmaceuticals, doctors and healthcare workers are literally prescribing community-based interventions.
Like what?
They refer patients to local group gardening projects, community arts programs, or multi-generational exercise classes. These interventions are designed to restore autonomy, physical presence, and a sense of purpose within a physical space, rather than forcing a vulnerable demographic into a confusing and isolating digital interface.
Okay, so we have diagnosed the vast scope of the damage. We've explored the biological metabolic debt, the CTRA epigenetic shifts,
the psychological junk food of parasocial relationships,
the sociological treadmill of frenetic standstill, and the architectural collapse of our third places. The picture is undeniably bleak. But we must pivot now to how we actively dismantle this isolation. We need to shift into the philosophical frameworks and the highly actionable practices that can restore our resonance.
Finding a sustainable way out requires more than just, you know, life hacks or limiting screen time. It requires a profound philosophical shift in how we view our existence. We have to address the root cause of existential loneliness, which, according to the fractal worldview, stems from the deeply ingrained illusion of separation.
This philosophical framework offers such a beautiful counter-narrative to our hyper-individualized culture. The modern ego trains us from birth to view the world as a hyper-competitive, zero-sum landscape.
It's always my success versus your failure.
My boundaries versus your demands. We are conditioned to see ourselves as isolated, mechanical units fighting against a hostile universe. But the fractal perspective argues that separation is merely a veil. We are, in reality, living nodes in a massive, interconnected, collective field of consciousness.
Think of it like a single leaf on a massive oak tree operating under the delusion that it is entirely separate from the branches, the trunk, and the root system.
Oh, that's a great image.
The leaf expends massive amounts of energy trying to sustain itself, terrified of the wind, unaware that the sap flowing through its veins is provided by the entire collective structure of the tree.
Mm.
When you realize you are part of the tree, the existential terror of isolation dissolves.
There is a profound concept within this worldview. Let me pull this quote from the source text. It is the one light recognizing itself in a different mirror.
That's beautiful.
It is. When you look into the eyes of another human being and you feel that sudden, inexplicable stirring of empathy or connection, you are experiencing the underlying unity of the field. You do not heal loneliness by desperately grasping at other people to fill an empty void in your chest. You heal it by realizing you inherently belong to the whole. As the framework notes, the wound is where the light enters the bond. Our shared vulnerability is the exact point of connection.
That is the philosophical essence of resonance. However, embodying that philosophy requires daily intentional practice to overcome the immense friction of modern life. By synthesizing public health strategies, neurobiology, and this fractal philosophy, we can outline a robust 7-step belonging framework to help rebuild that connection for you.
Let's run through these steps, looking at how they directly apply to the friction of daily life. Step one is replace visibility with presence. We establish that visibility is a passive digital metric chasing views, likes, followers. Presence, however, is a highly active, energetic state.
Presence requires you to drop the curated mask. It demands that you physically and mentally inhabit the space you are in.
So put the phone away.
Put the phone away. When you are sitting across from your partner at the dinner table or getting coffee with a friend, you must actively put the device out of sight. Your undivided attention, your sustained eye contact, and the orientation of your body actively signal safety to the other person's nervous system. You are granting them the immense biological gift of co-regulation.
Step two expands on this. Practice deep listening. The sources refer to this as offering spiritual hospitality.
Mm.
Most of our modern communication is incredibly performative.
We are usually just waiting for our turn to speak.
Right, silently formulating our counterargument or immediately trying to fix the other person's problem so the uncomfortable emotion just goes away.
Spiritual hospitality requires suspending the ego's innate need to intervene, fix, or dominate the narrative. It involves holding space for the other person's reality without judgment. You are listening to the emotional frequency beneath their words, allowing them the rare experience of feeling truly, comprehensively seen.
Moving to step three, create small rituals. We discussed earlier how the disappearance of rituals leaves us unanchored in the rushing stream of modern time. To combat this, we have to intentionally manufacture our own anchors.
And importantly, these do not need to be elaborate or time-consuming ceremonies. The power of a ritual lies entirely in its predictable repetition.
It could just be a walk.
Exactly. A commitment to a weekly Saturday morning walk in the park with a neighbor, with a strict rule of no technology. By doing this consistently, you are building community without communication. You are establishing a reliable rhythm of belonging that your nervous system can anticipate and rest within.
Step four is critical for healing the broader societal fractures we talked about. Build intergenerational relationships. We are far too comfortable remaining in our demographic silos, associating only with people who share our exact age, income bracket, and cultural references.
Breaking out of those silos provides immense mutual benefit. It combines the lived perspective, patience, and historical context of older adults with the dynamic vitality and fresh perspective of the youth.
Volunteering at a senior center or seeking out mentorship across generations shatters the illusion of separation and integrates the community.
Step five requires a radical shift in how we view our own experiences. Reduce performative tech use.
Stop documenting every moment for external validation.
Right. We have developed this compulsion to document every single moment of our lives. We take a photo of our meal before we taste it. We record a concert instead of actually dancing to it.
This performative documentation constantly pulls you out of the present moment and forces you to view your own life from the perspective of an imagined audience. You must fiercely protect the sanctity of your inner life. You do not need to post a picture of a sunset for the sunset to be beautiful.
By starving the algorithmic impulse to broadcast, you force yourself to seek validation through direct, embodied relationships and internal quiet.
Step six offers the fastest route out of the echo chamber of depression. Serve locally. When we experience severe loneliness, we often become trapped in a narcissistic loop of our own suffering. Our focus narrows entirely onto our own pain and isolation.
Service is the biological and psychological antidote to that loop. By actively helping someone else, whether volunteering at a local food bank, participating in a neighborhood cleanup, or simply assisting a neighbor, you empirically prove to your own brain that you hold a vital, necessary role within the tribe.
It fundamentally shifts your self-perception from a burden to a contributor, immediately turning off the evolutionary alarm bells.
And finally, step seven, emotional availability. We spend so much energy building armor to protect ourselves from being hurt, but that same armor is exactly what isolates us. Emotions are messengers, not masters.
Integrating your shadow, basically.
Exactly. This means stopping the internal war against your own vulnerabilities, fears, and perceived inadequacies. When you accept your messy, imperfect self, you project a safe, grounded, energetic field. You implicitly grant the people around you permission to drop their own armor. True connection is only possible when two people feel safe enough to be profoundly authentic.
So, to synthesize the immense territory we have covered today on this deep dive, loneliness is far more than just a fleeting feeling of sadness on a weekend. It is a severe biological crisis that drives your body into metabolic debt, rewrites your genetic expression through the CTRA profile, and floods your system with inflammation.
It is a macro-sociological crisis driven by the frenetic acceleration of modern capitalism and the paving over of our physical third places.
And ultimately, it is a spiritual crisis rooted in the illusion that we are separate from the whole.
But the capacity for true connection remains intact within our biology. It simply requires the courage to dismantle the protective walls of the ego and the willingness to step into the uncontrollable reciprocal resonance of another human being. We cannot heal this crisis by generating more digital noise or consuming more notifications. We heal it by physically and emotionally re-entering the stream of shared human life.
Which brings us to the end of our journey today. But before you take off those headphones and step back into your day, we want to leave you with a final lingering thought.
We've spent an hour discussing how to reconnect in a world that pushes us apart. But consider the underlying cultural narrative that drives us into isolation in the first place. What if our entire cultural definition of a successful adult is fundamentally dangerously flawed? Well, from early childhood, we are indoctrinated with the belief that the pinnacle of success is total self-sufficiency. We are taught that true maturity means financial independence, emotional stoicism, and never truly needing anyone else to survive.
But if our neurobiology desperately demands physical load sharing just to keep our immune systems functioning properly,
yeah.
and if our DNA literally alters itself to prepare for physical trauma when we are isolated, what if the ultimate act of rebellion in 2026 isn't just deleting an app or putting down your smartphone?
What if the highest form of human success is actively, intentionally choosing to be deeply, messily, and uncontrollably dependent on another human being?
Wow. Rejecting the myth of independence changes the entire architecture of how we live.
It changes everything.
Because when you step back out into that meticulously engineered, hypervisible world today, remember that the digital networks might be hollow and the cultural waters might be murky, but you are not an island. You are an essential node in a living, breathing, collective field. Thank you for joining us today and for bringing your presence to this exploration. We will catch you next time.